The following is part of a seminar by Joe Rigney, Assistant Professor of Theology and Christian Worldview at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. For more information about the college and seminary, please visit bcsmn.org.
So how do you enjoy things that might be mixed, like novels that have a mixture of good and bad, or television, sports, things like that? So I think part of the answer is it depends on your heart. What are you looking for in it? So I think that the fundamental thing is, if everything can reveal God, and I think everything can, what are you looking for? Are you watching the football game because they showed the cheerleaders every now and then? That's one of the reasons. That's bad. That's a sin. But if you're watching it because you just enjoy the football and you like, I mean, I think there's all kinds of images of divine things in watching sports. Right? Paul does that, right? He talks about running races, beating his own body, right? He's seen some races, he's seen competitions, and he thinks there's metaphors here that I can use to help understand spiritual life. Physical training is of some value, so you've got playing sports, not just spectating. And then the other thing I'd say is, even the bad stuff in stories, like you're reading a novel and there's evil in it, horrific things, well, that's a picture too, right? That's it. So remember that. That, why do you look at that? Narnia has the White Witch. Middle Earth has Sauron and Saruman. And you look at these guys, and what's the point of them? Well, they're good pictures of evil in this world. They help you understand what evil is like. They help you get a better picture of that. And so the concern is, if you're reading the things because you're drawn to the evil, right? You're drawn to enjoy or delight in the evil in itself, or if you're drawn to it because you love to see the bad guys get it in the end. Right? That part of it, because that's the story, that's the kind of story you're in. You're in a story where eventually the dragon gets killed. That's where we're headed. And so if you like stories where dragons get killed and all the other evil characters, then you can read them in that way. So you read the story and you say, gosh, and you feel something, right? When the evil is triumphing, say in the middle of the book, right? You're watching the movie and the bad guy's winning for like the first, you know, two-thirds of the movie. And you're just, something rises up in your heart like, no, it shouldn't be this way. Okay, that's, what's that doing? It's taking you out of yourself. It's awakening something in your soul. And it ought to send you back into the world feeling that way about the kinds of evil you face in this world. It shouldn't be this way. God, do something about all of the evil here. And so I think that even that can be a spiritually beneficial, heart-expanding sort of reality. Probably other reasons I could think of if I thought about it. Other questions? Yeah. Okay, good. So what do you do if you're not enjoying a gift for some reason? You're not fully engaged. How do you cultivate it? This is good. This is actually part of the closing exhortation, so I can work that into this answer. For me, practically speaking, the most helpful thing for me in trying to get my heart engaged in this way is gratitude for specific things. So when you think about Romans 1 on the other side of the new birth, and you've got that right worship, honoring God as God, and then you've got giving thanks. I think that one of the reasons we're deficient in this area is that we only give thanks in generic terms, or we only give thanks for specific things that are big. Give thanks when the cancer goes away. Right? We give thanks for that kind of big thing. But do you give thanks for the world? I'm wearing wool socks right now. I like wool socks. And I thank God for them regularly, actually. And it's that sort of thing. Because what you're doing, when you periodically and regularly give thanks for specific, mundane, incidental, little things, little pleasures, is you're training your heart to be aware of them. You're drawing attention to the fact that, hey, you know what? My bed is actually kind of comfortable. Or, man, that really tasted good. That specific thing, not just thank you for the food. Thank you for this food because it tastes this way. Or thank you for that little quirk of personality in my son. Here's a practical thing. If you wanted to, what would I say? First step, you want to do this? And it would be something like, make it a regular practice to say thank you for specific things, to make lists of things. Really, and I would say if you really struggle with getting a big enough picture, I would force for every spiritual thing, like, Lord, thank you that Jesus died for my sins, I would say do 4 really mundane, insignificant things. Force yourself to think about them. And what you'll find is over time, as you get just practice and habit, as you cultivate an awareness of, wow, I really like that, and I really like that, and wow, that was really kind of God, and boy, that was a really great coincidence, providence. You just get dialed into it, and all of a sudden you're starting to spot other things, and what's that doing? That's heart expansion. And so here, let me show you. Here's gratitude, I think, is the posture of the soul that most readily promotes receptivity. Okay? I think gratitude is how you respond to grace from past grace and present grace. Gratitude is what you're doing now for the things that God is being kind to you now. Faith is how you orient towards future grace. So Piper, you know, hammers on that pretty good. So gratitude is past and present grace. Faith is the action of the soul in the present about God's going to keep doing stuff like this for me. Wow, that's great. So how does gratitude work? Try this. I'm thankful for cool autumn days and the brilliant colors that ride on them. For my wife's diligent efforts to care for me and our boys, especially when it's hard. For the college guys who help me with the yard work. For my in-laws who will be visiting for the next week or so. For 7 years of splendor and grace in marriage. That God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills and sometimes sells some cows in order to provide for our needs. That I get to teach and invest at Bethlehem College and Seminary. I just marvel all the time that I have the job I have. I just sit there and I just go, what did I do? The answer is nothing, right? It's God's kind. So I just give thanks for the little things about my job that I like, and that actually helps not only increase the gratitude, but endure the stuff that I don't. That I have 2 pillows to sleep with at night, one under my head and one between my knees. That the kingdom advances when I'm faithful at my post. For Narnia and the North, for the gifts, talents, and successes of others. For Parkway Pizza and Oatmeal Stout, for the ability to think and remember. I'll tell you this, watching my dad lose his memory has deeply increased my gratitude for my ability to think clearly and to remember things, because it's not a given that I'll always have that. And so while I have it, I want to use it with all my might. That God governs the affairs of men and that Jesus paid it all. So just get specific. Talk about specific little things. Everybody has them, and your alls are going to be different, and that's good. And just cultivate that practice of thank you for that. Thank you for that. And then you'll just find that you're recognizing, oh, there's more of them. I thought there was only like 4, but it turns out there's about 50,000. And now I'm more alive. I'm looking on the lookout for ways that God is being kind to me. Really good question. Other questions? Yeah, good. So the question is, it's one thing to talk about press into a gift that you're losing when it's being lost. What about after, when the child dies and now you have to think about, am I just living in the past? So what I would say is, A, I'm not going to put a time limit on it. Okay. B, I would say, if it's something like that, if it's that kind of serious loss, I would say you're probably never going to get over it, and you shouldn't expect to. And you shouldn't feel pressure to. Okay? So both of those, I think, are fundamental. So A, the grieving process is different for every person, and you're not going to force somebody into a preset thing. This is how it always has to look. No. People are different. People grieve differently. And 2, you may never get over it. You may be like Jacob and always have that limp. I've heard Pastor John talk about his mom. And he says, I can cry at the drop of a hat. I just have to think about her in a certain way, and boom, the tears will come. And that's true for me about my dad, right? Most of the time, I'm pretty functional. But I know that right now, I could think about certain memories I have with him, certain things that he used to do. I can think about all the things that I won't get to do with him, or that my grandsons won't get to do with him. And I can cry, I could just bawl my eyes out right now. I know that. And I can choose not to. Right? I can choose to not go there in my mind. Right? This is self-control. And therefore not have that emotion just kind of well up spontaneously. So I don't know that I'll ever get over that loss. I know my brothers struggle with the fact that my dad was unable to be there at their weddings. He was there for mine, but he won't be there for theirs, and that's hard for them. And I wouldn't expect them to ever really kind of, like, that's always going to be like a sore thing. So does that mean then, okay, you're free to just grieve however you want? There's no parameters. And I'd say no. I'd say one goal, however long it takes. Well, one fundamental thing is not cursing God like we talked about. But another thing I'd say is if your grief prevents you from giving thanks for the things, the other things in your life that God's given you, like your spouse if you've lost a child, or friends if you've lost other family or whatever, if it's getting in the way of even doing those things, and it does so, and again, I'm not going to put a specific time, but if it's hindering that, I'd say that something is maybe going wrong in the grieving process, and you need faithful people to rally to you and pray with you and try to figure out what that's like. And so the goal should be not that you're bitter forever or angry forever or just a wreck forever. You may never get over it, but the point in losing it, God has expanded your heart and there's more things that He has for you. Your life isn't over, essentially. And so give time, but don't, I think one of the things, at least, is I've talked to grieving people and thought about, particularly my mom, as I think about what's life going to be like when my dad finally dies. I don't think God or my dad, and I certainly don't, if she moves on, say she got remarried, she's pretty young, she's only in her 50s, late 50s. And so say she decides to get remarried, and or if you lose a child and you have another child, you're not honoring the child or the spouse that you lost by refusing to enjoy things that God brings into your life, right? You need not feel guilt. In other words, you need not feel guilty if here's something else that I enjoy, and if I enjoy it, that somehow demeans the preciousness of what I lost. And I think that there's a kind of guilt that can happen in the soul. And I would want to try to work through that and say, it's okay to grieve, but you shouldn't grieve out of some kind of obligation that if you stop grieving in the way that you did initially, right after it happened, that you're somehow dishonoring the loss. Or it doesn't mean anything to you. No, it just means grief goes through seasons. And you need to let it progress in that way. And then I'd come back again and say, everybody's going to be different. And it's going to take wisdom in a particular situation. Right. Yeah. Yeah, good. So the question is, what about vocation specifically as it relates to evangelism? Maybe one way to put it would be, is the only value of your vocational ministry or is the main value in the evangelistic opportunities that it presents? And I would say that certainly is a value of it. The opportunities, if you come into contact with unbelievers in your job, that's certainly a place that you ought to be praying for. I mean, I work with Christians all the time, and I teach college students who are Christians. Right? I'm not around unbelievers in my daily life a whole lot, other than maybe my neighbors. So you guys that have jobs are actually the ones who get frontline stuff when it comes to that. So that's certainly a value, but I would say it's not the only value, and so that doing a faithful job, right, doing whatever it is that you're doing, working at it with all your might as unto the Lord, is honoring to God regardless of whether it presents you with an opportunity to share the gospel. Now, Lord willing, that's the sort of thing, right? You know, the one who does a good job, he's going to stand before kings, right? God's going to open up opportunities. You're going to have a chance to say things. That's probably going to happen, and you should pray for and desire those. But if God's not bringing them, and all you're doing is faithfully going to the office and doing what you do, looking for opportunities they present, but yeah, I would say a rhythmic idea there. Creatively thinking about how to, maybe if there's opportunities, you know, like same thing with your neighbors or something like that. Like I read of a church the other day said, you know, why don't just pick the two houses next to you on either side and maybe the ones across the street and just pray about could you have an opportunity there. And then leave it to God to answer the prayer. Like That's part of the thing is, okay, you can only be faithful where God plants you. So pray and say, God, I'm willing. I'm ready. Give me the courage in the moment. And so I want to do these things. Please provide me the opportunities. And then when he does, act in faith. And if he doesn't, right this minute, don't feel guilt and stop praying. Because that's what happens. You'll feel guilty that, oh, he didn't answer the prayer immediately, so he must not want me to pray that. So that's not how it works. That's not how it works. It takes time, and there are seasonal type things, but there's still real value simply in a job well done. Simply in faithfully doing that, in developing creation, in ministering to needs, whatever your vocation is, there's still real value simply in itself as an act of devotion to the Lord, working unto the Lord as to God, not to man. So yes, I think that you don't need to just say the only value of vocation is evangelistic opportunities. You certainly shouldn't say that. Maybe one or two more questions. And again, I'll stay after if you have others that you want to come up. Yes. Good. So your question is, I've had a lot of hard things. I've been through a lot of stuff. And so when I see other people get gifts, say that I was denied, that I didn't get, or that I had hard things happen, I have a hard time being happy for them. I would say that right there is a place to really, I would devote lots of prayer to that. I think that is one of the main things, especially in our day, that will set Christians off from everybody else. The ability to be happy for the gifts of others, in other words, the opposite of kind of an envy, malice, rivalry, competition, tear people down, happy when they lose stuff, that's very prevalent in our culture, right? That's just the way we operate. It's behind that kind of envious thing is real. And it's real in Christians, right? It's real. I've experienced it, still experience it. When others get opportunities or have blessings that I don't. And I think one of the main things that God wants to do in my life and in your lives is to work on that so that you're grateful not only for the things that God gives you, but for the things that he gives others. That there's a real deep sense of glory to God when somebody else gets something that you did, that you don't get or didn't have. And I would say that your ability to enjoy what God gives you is directly related to your ability to rejoice in what God gives others. So that if you can't rejoice when other people get good gifts, you probably won't be able to rejoice in the gifts properly that you have. Because there's always kind of, it's a Cain and Abel mentality, right? It's a, God accepted Abel and didn't like what I brought, and so now I'm really angry that he got accepted, and I want, and there's this kind of competition and rivalry. And you see that all throughout the Bible. You see it with Joseph and his brothers. This is just fundamental to human, Jacob and Esau, Christians, you're all brothers, and you just look at the Bible and all the descriptions of brothers, and you go, I'm not sure that that's a good thing, you know, like, I don't know that there's a whole lot of sibling relationships that turned out well, but that's the point. That's what the gospel is intending to do, is to restore those kind of relationships so that other people's success brings you a deep delight. And I found this to be really true in my own life. I make a really concerted effort, especially in my heart, sometimes and out loud when I have opportunity, when other people get things, to get to do things, get to have opportunities, get receive blessings that I don't receive, I want to just be effusive in my heart, like, thank God that they got that. I'm so glad for you. I'm so glad that God blessed you in that way. Doesn't mean that I don't hurt if I don't get it, right? Like if I don't have something, but I don't ever want that to be a unhappiness in the success of them. And I think that Christians will really stand out, if you're happy when other people are blessed. I think that will be a huge testimony. Why? Because God's lavish. That's not a zero-sum game. If they get something, doesn't mean I can't get something. There's enough to go around. He's not going to run out of blessings. So I think that's a really big deal. Last question. I'll talk to you later. Other questions? Any of you that I don't know well that Susan can just wait. Any of you? Other questions? Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, so funny you should mention that. I happen to work for a college, and we have programs where students just come and read old books that have stood the test of time. So the question was, what's the particular value of kind of classics, things that have stood the test of time, music, literature, things like that? Here's just maybe a simple answer. I think that one of the main things, the question I have about stuff like that is, why did it stand the test of time? There's books that were written that got tossed in the ash heap, and nobody reads those ones anymore. What is it about this one that makes it so valuable? And that's the question that I have, and that's why I would be interested in reading it. And I think that one of the main things is great books, classics, music that's sort of stood the test of time, is the sort of thing that speaks in a particularly powerful way to the human condition. In all, whether it's unbelievers or believers writing this stuff, for some reason, it resonates with something about us. And therefore, as Christians, I want to understand, what is that? What is this book really ministering to? Why is it that people just can't, over hundreds of years, just want to come back again and again? What is it about it? And in a lot of cases, given, the history of things, most of those books were written by, a lot of them were written by Christians. Up until the last 200-300 years, they were all, right? You got the Greeks earlier, and then once the Christian era starts, it's all Christian stuff in one form or fashion or another, right? And so I just want to say that's our legacy. Right? We stand on the shoulders of those guys, and those guys were doing what we ought to be thinking about doing. We ought to be trying to create things, works of art, works of literature, works of music, that stand the test of time, that last, that minister over ages. And having said that's a really worthwhile endeavor, and some of you should get on it. The other thing that we ought to be doing is creating stuff that's going to be consumed and forgotten in the next day and a half. There's value in that. There's value in sort of daily bread. So I don't know hardly anything about sort of popular music. I don't listen to it. I do think it's valuable. I do think that there's a kind of value in things that are meant to be consumed. And that there shouldn't be a kind of, well, that's just that. We're above that. That's snobbery, and I just think that's silly. I laugh at snobs. It drives them nuts. And just think there's value in both, but I do think that we should ask ourselves, what is it about these things that awaken something in the human soul, and how then does the gospel, how does God, what is it in relation to Scripture, in the triune God that we ought to meet that need or make a similar kind of resonance in it. So, yeah, I do think that's very valuable. Okay, so here's the closing exhortation. The heart of what I'm commending here in the whole earth is full of His glory, honoring the giver by enjoying His gifts, is simply this. Embrace your creatureliness. Embrace your redeemed, blood-bought, born-again creatureliness. At the heart of creatureliness is receptivity, because God is fundamentally a giver. That's what He is. In relation to us, He is fundamentally a giver, which means that one of the main things we ought to do is learn what it means to participate, which involves, again, that two-way, receiving all that God has for us and then becoming like God in giving, not to God, we don't give anything to Him, but in being the channel of giving to others, meeting the needs of others. That's the heart of it. God gives to life to all men life and breath and everything. He opens his hand, satisfies the desire of every living thing. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. The Father gives to us his son and gives us to his son. The Father and Son together give us the Holy Spirit. The Spirit gives us comfort and grace and power and himself in our hearts and in our midst as an everlasting dwelling place. God is fundamentally a giver, which means we must learn to give. And we want to be like God in it. We want to be grateful for all of it. And so, if you're awash in a sea of gifts, then just dive in and savor it. Just enjoy it. I hope that you really enjoy things in a different way after this weekend. Receive them gladly, give thanks for them, and then look for the needs that he intends for you to meet. If you're losing things, press into the loss. Don't run from it. Don't be stoic. Don't be detached. God has something for you in the loss. He's going to meet you in the loss in ways that you just don't know yet. And so again, all you have is Christ. You have him in everything. You have him in all the good gifts he lavishes. You have him in all the gifts that you receive and then give away. And you have him in the loss of everything precious to you. And so as you go, may the Father of lights, who knows how to give good gifts to his children, teach you the secret of facing plenty and want, abundance and need, hunger and fullness, so that you have the grace to do all things, receive all things, endure all hard things through Christ who gives you strength.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this presentation to distribute to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content without written permission from Bethlehem College and Seminary. For more information about our school, including information on academics, faculty, and admissions, please visit us at bcsmn.org.